And welcome back to the podcast. If you're new here, I'm Sheen, your host. And today we're in Doha, Qatar with Yusuf Omar. If you don't know who Yusuf is, I think there are two things that comes to mind for me when I think of you. The first one is he's completely revolutionizing how journalism is done, and he's the future of reporting.
Thank you.
The second thing is he wears really ugly outfits.
Damn. My biggest critic. Every time I come down, it's like, oh, you're wearing that on my podcast? Oh, okay.
You wore something nice the other day. I'm sad you didn't wear it today.
This is my airplane outfit. I'm flying tonight. I've been flying so much. I've had 15 flights in the last 10 days or so. I'm exhausted.
All right, tell us why. Why are you flying so much?
I'm flying so much because I'm screaming as loud as we can about Gaza, and it sometimes feels like nobody's listening. And we're creating all these incredible documentaries by kids on the ground with their mobile phones, but they're not reaching the people who need to see them because people are in their own social media echo chambers. We've seen a feed for the last 16 months that is bloody and is scarred into our minds, but many Americans haven't. So every single month, we're going to the Zionist capitals of the world, be it DC, New York, Beverly Hills, Toronto, and we're showing them these films and we're changing hearts and minds. That's why I'm traveling a lot at the moment.
Okay. In the interest of time, give us a brief intro of who Yusuf is.
Yeah, I am a storyteller. I used to be a war correspondent. I was in Syria, Congo, Egypt, Sudan. I got disenfranchised with traditional media. I was like, man, you can spend your whole life trying to fix these old companies. But we decided to build a new one. My co-founder and I, Sameya, my wife.
Hi, Sameya.
Started Scene TV. We trained up thousands of people around the world how to tell stories with their phones. And we started curating that into shows. Today, we've got 8 million subscribers. We've generated over $10 million in advertising revenue. And we're focused on the stuff that matters, we think.
Okay. So now we're just going to jump right into it. You know, there's no sugarcoating here. Mm. First question for you, and I think I've told you this already. What we love to discuss here is important pivots in life. And pivots can be professional, can be personal. Mm. What do you think has been the most definitive pivot in your life?
I think for most of my life, I held Western culture and values on a bit of a pedestal. I actually believed the American dream. I studied in California, in Long Beach, and I loved it. I loved everything it represented and the idea that you could make it and you could have the, you know, the car that you see on like Pimp My Ride and the house that you see on Cribs. And I think post-Gaza, that entire vision has been completely demolished. And the biggest pivot in my life has actually been a shift back to Islam, back to being Muslim, back to that value system. It was kind of like the West revealed its ugly true colors and that it actually didn't give a shit about freedom of expression or freedom of press or the rights of people or human dignity. And I ended up thinking to myself, you want to be like those guys? Your whole life, you want to, that's the guys.
People who don't like us?
That's the guys you want to be like. You think that's cool? And it's like, no, that's not cool. Like, we're cool. Mm. We're actually civilized, truly civilized. And are caring and have a heart and have empathy. So that's the biggest pivot that's happened. I'm going through that pivot right now. I'm nowhere near the end of that journey, but like I'm pivoting back to Islam. I'm pivoting back to my value system being aligned with that and not the West.
I mean, that's beautiful. I generally thought you would bring us back a while ago in terms of pivots, right? Because you left corporate world, you started your own business. Mm. And you're trying to do things that traditional media doesn't necessarily do. But it's pretty amazing, isn't it? And you know how many people are talking about how Gaza has really made them rethink their relationship with their faith, especially when they see how resilient the Palestinian people are. Mm. But that's beautiful. And how does it feel for you now to know that this is the new journey, especially with Islam, with religion at this age? Like, how does it feel?
Such a beautiful thing when your values align with your work, align with everything. Just things just feel right. In some way, like before this, I felt like in some ways we were like getting in bed with the devil. Mm. You know, you're helping organizations and partners that don't value align with you, that are doing things that you don't feel comfortable about. And after October 7th, when we went big on Gaza, we published over 600 videos, we generated like a billion views. We lost a lot of partners. We lost $1 million worth of work in the 6 months after October 7th. We had organizations just email us and be like, sorry, we can't work with you because you're supporting terrorism. And I'm like, we're doing stories about kids in Gaza. That's supporting terrorism. The point is, like, in that short term, it was dark. We were losing money. We started losing revenue. But in the long term, new doors opened. When one door closes, another one opens. And jump forward to today, alhamdulillah, we're in a way healthier place with true friends and true organizations that we want to grow with. And Gaza kind of forced that on us. It forced that hand. It forced you to say, who are you really? What do you really care about?
But that's such an interesting thing to mention because, I was just thinking, in our world, right, our industry of creators, a lot of times you will hear that, I kind of need work. I need to make money. I'm in the early stages of creating content.
Mm.
I can't really be picky.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you will see people kind of putting their values on pause just to make money and hoping that once I have a seat at the table, then I can make better decisions.
I hear that all the bloody time. Once I'm a really big deal, I will be so big on Palestine. I will say everything. And they're just waiting to get a seat on the table. But what they don't realize is there's always the next table. Don't worry when I get there. And what you end up doing is you end up pandering to the West. You end up becoming a coconut. You end up, you never make it. The best time to speak up is always now. And yes, I understand there are many people who have jobs and families and bills to play. And if you are working for somebody else, I don't judge you. I don't judge you. But if you are a creator, it is different. You have been given a God-given microphone, an amplification. You are on a stage. And what you do with that is a hell of a responsibility. In Islamic wisdom, there's a prophetic saying that if you see a wrongdoing, the Prophet spoke about the idea that the first thing to do is to feel it is wrong. The second thing to do is to say something about it. And the third thing to do is to act on it. We all have a responsibility somewhere on that spectrum. So I just think it's excuses. And I get it. The safest place to be is in the middle, is to say nothing. But I think that was the old world. I think in the old world, even brands didn't take positions. In the new world, brands do take positions. If Nike are able to be pro-LGBTQI and Pride, pro-Black Lives Matter, these are positions. Apple took the same positions. So I think we, people who take a stand, who are valued, who have a position, in the long term, history is going to judge them very well. And the people that are going to be in the middle, while it's the safe thing to do right now, in the long term, they're just going to be lost.
What do you stand for, right?
What do you stand for?
Yeah. Okay. So tell me, another question personally I have for you is you do such great work, first of all, with Scene.
Thank you.
I'm very proud of you. But does it take a toll on you emotionally to deal with that level of hurt and pain around the world and the kind of apathy that you see around?
Because I've seen too much. I was a journalist on the front line of the Syrian war, right? I the guy whose house I stayed at died. I have had colleagues that have lost their lives. I've seen the absolute worst of humanity. And in that respect, I can never, ever feel sorry for myself or feel this is a difficult job. This is the easiest job in the world. I'm paid to do what I would do for free. What a beautiful idea.
Wow. Okay. And tell us a little bit. Well, we're talking about this. I feel like I'm jumping around. This is our conversation. So much ADHD. But you travel a lot for work.
Yeah.
Right? And a lot of people would love to do that.
Yeah.
Be able to travel for work while working for yourself.
Be careful what you wish for because you just might get it.
So tell us, how does that happen?
Yeah. So, I've traveled in various contexts, but one of the main ones is as a speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And that is if you want to travel the world for free, get free business class flights, free hotels, and get paid, being an international speaker is one of the best ways to do that. And there's actually a really simple way to do it. Do one speech on one stage anywhere in the world. It could be a community stage. It could be the smallest thing ever. Film it like we're filming this right now and turn that into a sizzle and get that sizzle over to speaking bureaus, speaking agents, and also just the people that coordinate events. And as long as you're not boring, as long as you say things that are controversial but true, you will find yourself onto stages. Because right now there's a unique opportunity across every industry to get up there as people of color and say, hey, you old guard, you don't know what you're doing. There is a different way. That's where we made it. Right? We came in and we said, traditional media are failing everybody. You suck. Right? They're like, okay, well, you're right. We are failing. That's an undeniable truth. You suck. It's kind of controversial, But like, all right, let's hear it out. And they might not agree with you, but like, there's a huge, and then you do that, you give one great speech, in the audience there's 20 people who invite you to the next conference. The next thing you know, you can be charging $20,000, $30,000 per speech, traveling around the world. So for your audience, like if you want to get onto that international like lifestyle of traveling, speaking is a really effective way to do that.
Okay, I understand that it snowballs, but how, I know the question that will come is, how do you find the people that you need to pitch to?
Hey dreamers, quick pause from the convo. If you are wondering what the Dreamers Digest is, it's my exclusive online community where I share behind-the-scenes goodies, lessons from building this podcast, and all the juicy stuff that never makes it to the final cut. If you're not in it yet, check the link in the show notes and come join us. It's 100% free. Also, shocking fact, 89% of you watching this on YouTube right now are not even subscribed. Wild, right? So if that's you, go ahead and hit that button. It would mean the world to me. And now, super exciting news. We launched the Podcast Academy. This is where I've poured everything I've learned from taking this show to 150 million views and turning it into a real business. It's 10 powerful modules packed with tools to help you launch, grow, and actually monetize your podcast. You'll even get the chance to submit your episode for personal feedback from me and my team. If you've been thinking about starting a show or scaling the one you already have, this is your sign. Click the link in the description box below to learn more. Now, back to the episode.
You don't need to, they'll find you. As long as you are genuinely controversial but true, that content will travel the internet and it'll be inbound. And if it's not traveling, then you're not saying something particularly unique.
Controversial, but true.
Controversial, but true.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, but controversial, it's like things that you'll be surprised what is controversial. Like, for example, we've got 8 million subscribers. The majority of them, 70% of them are women aged 13 to 34. So we have a very young base of women. Why did that happen? All we did was, we have a team of mostly young women that run the company. Samaya, my co-founder and wife, is the editor-in-chief. And they leaned into stories like body positivity, menstrual hygiene, mm-hmm. periods. Mm-hmm. Half of the world's adult population will have a period once a month. Yet, because old white men traditionally run media companies, that was a taboo.
Ew.
That was a stigma. They didn't cover period stories or period poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that's a controversial but true topic. It's a reality that many young women around the world who can't get menstrual hygiene products, can't go to school or work and have to sit at home, and it impacts their economy. Seeing TV being able to do that, talk about that, make stories about that, speak about that on stages around the world is a controversial but true idea. And that's how we grew a young female audience. And I think sometimes people think, going after like minority audiences or underserved audiences is like the nice, politically correct, fluffy thing to do. It also makes business sense.
Mm.
Like woman as a vertical across wellness, health, food, education, media is potentially the most underserved audience in the world. More than half the world are women, right? It's like 51%. Yet the majority of decision makers in these traditional organizations are men. They are not catering to women. There is such a big market in every single vertical. And I think people are starting to realize that. They're starting to build businesses around like female sports.
Yep. Women's health as well is booming now.
Huge opportunity. And we were able to really push into that opportunity in the media space.
Oh, wow. I love that. You literally made me think. I was like, I don't even capitalize on that. I don't think about what are the controversial topics when it comes to women.
Taboos, which are actually not taboos.
They're not taboos. They should not be taboos.
They should not be. But because old white men in these media companies are defining what is and isn't news, they haven't touched those topics.
That's so interesting. Okay, so you talked about your female audience.
Yeah.
I know you also have a huge female team.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
How is it working with women?
Wow, what a question. Superb. I mean, I hate to generalize around any gender or racial profile, but like, for the most part, every newsroom that I've ever worked in, every good newsroom that I've worked in has been led by women. I think the skills required to be a great journalist and a great storyteller, I don't know why. Women tend to dominate most of the newsrooms I've ever worked in. Most of my bosses have always been women in newsrooms.
Yeah, I think it also comes from the fact that women have a lot more empathy, right? So when it comes to leadership and stuff, they can understand a little bit better how to approach things. I don't know. That's what the statistics say. But, okay, what else do you want to talk about?
Well, just on that topic, like if I think about Samaya, like my co-founder, she really, really overthinks how every story that we do impacts everybody around it. How does this impact them positively and negatively? She fully... Whereas I'm kind of like a bull in a china shop.
Let's just throw it out there.
Yeah. I think one thing that makes us really mad, and I'm sure you've experienced this too, Western people have such a skewed perception of the Middle East. When I'm posting on Instagram that I'm in Doha or Dubai, women that I know message me on Instagram and they're like, oh, it looks so beautiful, but I'd never live there because they're oppressive to women. And obviously there's truth to that in every culture around the world, but I don't think that they realize or appreciate how much our culture perceives their woman as being oppressed too.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear it.
Right? Just in different ways.
Yeah. To give more context, when I moved to Dubai, I got so much of these questions. One of them was, oh, but you know, will you have to cover your hair there in Dubai? Are you allowed to walk around freely? Can you drive? Do they take your passport?
Mm.
And all of these are just such racist questions.
It's just racist.
Fully racist because of the image that the West has of the Middle East in general.
Yeah.
And they don't know how much our life is better here.
But... yeah, and women out here, I often hear saying to those Westerners, well, I worry about you.
I do.
I worry that you're going to get on your university campuses, right? I worry that you're not able to walk home from a train station safely when it gets dark. And that's not to say that there's not in the yeah. Middle East, it exists too. But I think there's different levels of safety. And I think there's also sometimes Western people view Middle Eastern traditions and Islamic practices as controlling of women, and Muslims see those same practices as protecting. You know, you'll see somebody say, well, why wouldn't that man shake my hand? And we're like, because he respects you, right? Because he doesn't want to touch somebody who's not his wife. And I think there's just like these massive disconnects.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the ones that really is polarizing is people say, well, what about these custodianship laws? Mm-hmm. This idea that the woman can't travel alone. And I get that. I mean, my wife and sister and mother, they you know, travel the world alone. But I also just encourage people to understand the ethos or the value system that this comes from. And maybe, just maybe, there's a part of that is about like, I want to protect you,
mm-hmm.
right? I care for you. You're part of my family. You're my responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we can't deny that having a man around doesn't make you safer. When you're traveling and stuff, it does, right? Like, you know how women, there's all these statistics how when women run at night, they will cross the road if there's a group of men.
Mm.
But a man doesn't have to do that. So if you're traveling with them, automatically the safety goes up a little bit. So I understand what you're talking about.
Intentions,
right?
I just
right?
feel like they don't understand intentions.
Mm. And even when, okay, this is getting really like into the religious books, but if you think about the Quran and the way that we talk about women and the lives that the women had. We had women who were business women, right? The prophet's wife herself was like one of the biggest merchants. So it's never been a case of women should stay at home. They should not, you know, they should not work and stuff. So I don't understand the oppression.
So Western people turn around and say, well, in Saudi Arabia, women couldn't drive for a long time. And well, in parts of East Africa, they circumcise women.
It's
against
FGM, yeah.
And it's like, okay, that's a Saudi problem. Okay, that's an Eritrean problem. Why are you conflating religion with culture?
Mm.
Right? Should we do the same to you? Should we say, well, you've got the KKK. You like to lynch black people, don't you? We don't do that because we're not racist, right? We don't generalize an entire system or a group of people based on bad actors.
Yeah. And again, all of these things are like tribal activities that happens, right? It's not necessarily things associated to Islam, as you said. But no, agreed. And you have a son now,
mm-hmm.
right? You're a father. How are you raising a son that is culturally aware and a Muslim boy in this world where people look at him differently?
Yeah. Wow, that's a difficult question. No, it's interesting. Like, I think we made an interesting decision where his name is Noah. Do you? Samara and I argue about this because I think we were raised in a world where there was so much Islamophobia that we sometimes shied away from our identities.
Mm.
In school, I was Joe. I wasn't Yusuf. I was Joe.
Really?
Or then I became like Yomar, like Yusuf Omar. And I think these kids are growing up in a new world where they can celebrate and own their traditions. So they're trying to anglicize, westernize, like whitewash. But I think the unfortunate reality is like, even us calling him Noah as opposed to Nuh says that there is still a baggage and we didn't want him to go into this world with that baggage. That's why so many Muslim people name their kids Adam. Because mm-hmm. you can say Adam and Adam and white people understand it.
It goes both ways.
Yeah. So I don't know if I'm answering your question properly, but what I suppose I'm saying is it's unfortunate that we still even have to think about those considerations.
We do.
Of like, well, how will white people read this? Will they understand it? Will they judge it? Will it stop him getting a visa or a job? And that disgusts me a little bit. I hope when he's old enough, he can decide for himself if he wants to introduce himself as Noah or by an Arabic derivative of that.
Yeah, I mean, my parents always say this as well. They gave us really like names that are easy to pronounce, easy to write. No one will get it wrong.
Yeah.
Somehow people still get my name wrong, by the way.
How?
Everybody calls me Shireen.
Wow.
Yeah. And even after I correct them, I still get Shireen
it.
Back.
They desi it.
Or Arab.
Yeah.
It's all the Arabs as well.
Yeah.
With Shireen. But yeah, I have that. And I think that's why I like his name. I'm like, oh, Noah, I can see the Islamic connection. But at the same time, I'm like, oh, but it's okay.
They colonized you too. They colonized your mind.
Where the internalized colonization just comes out. But no, I think it's true though. One thing did happen is that now it's cool to be different.
Mm.
It's cool to be ethnically different.
I know.
Especially in the West, where, I mean, you are in Australia. Do you not consider moving to the Middle East?
I would love to be here. I'd love to not have to like ask every time I go to a restaurant, Is it halal?
And they're like, what is halal?
Or like on Friday, like, do you know where I can find a mosque for Jummah? Yeah, what is halal? Don't worry, there's no pork. I would love to be in a place where Noah can grow up and the majority of people mirror his value system and identity. Watch this space. Watch this space. Yusuf Omar and Scene TV coming to a Middle East near you.
Oh my goodness. Okay. And what's something about you that no one knows?
I think people in my company know, but outside of my company probably don't know that I'm a really tough boss. I don't know how to be a really likable founder and CEO. I'm so passionate about our work and I take everything so personally and I mean, people that like working with me like working with me, but I can be really difficult to work with.
I think that's so interesting because you're such a likable person and a friend to others.
Yeah.
To others.
Oh, shit.
Friend to others. But I do think that I find it hard to relate. How does that not relate to your work?
Imagine the same level of energy that you're seeing on this conversation, the same drive, the same passion. But now when I'm not happy with something, when I'm disappointed, when I expected one thing and got another, where I don't feel like you're, you know, giving it your all. But to be honest with you, like we've got 40 staff now and some of them have been with us for 7-8 years.
You're not scaring them off.
Yeah, when you find people that are value aligned and are working at the same pace and energy at you as you, then it works. At the moment I'm in a cycle where you're either with us for 1 month or 7 years and nothing in between.
But that's good, I guess. It's a quick filter.
Yeah, you figure out real soon, like, whoa. Or you're like, all right, let's do it.
Cool. But you know, I asked you this the other day for your 2025, what's your theme other than 2020 Thrive? Can you laugh? I made a joke.
I didn't get it the first time and I didn't get it the second time either.
You missed it this time as well. So what's the theme for Yusuf this year?
Unapologetic. speak truth to power, even if it has consequences, even if we lose deals. I don't care. There is a genocide happening right now. When Noah asked me, what did you do? I want to say I did everything in my power. I spoke and screamed as loud as I could. I dedicated as much of the company's resources to this as possible. So unapologetic.
Love that.
No fear, no favor.
Thank you, Yusuf. I hope this is like a part one. We'll need to do a proper one.
Oh, we're both getting canceled by part two.
That's all right. Okay, thank you.